and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the UCC argument when we come back. You know, when you're making $50,000 a year, you pay $7,650 in Social Security taxes. Then on top of that, you pay a 17% income tax on $50,000, and that's another $8,500. That means you just paid an extra $1,300 by paying your tax on a tax. That makes the real effective Social Security tax rate 17.8%. It's not the 15.3% that's been advertised. Isn't that just real special? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number's 417-273-4967. Help take a bite out of crime. Why don't you call and ask for my free general law CD package? It's a 4-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Our school, Tax and Status, is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about this thing of the UCC. In the first two programs, we covered the UCC and the history of it. The straw man is generally called the UCC straw man concept or argument. It includes such things as birth certificate, Social Security, Federal Reserve notes, zip codes, sovereignty, capacity, flags, nom de guerre, contracts, guardian-ward relationship. And various groups weave these subjects in and out of the fabric of the program, I guess we'll call it, called Straw Man. A very popular program. It kind of reminds me of the pilot connection. You know, it was a time, you know, 5 or 10 years ago when the pilot connection was a very popular patriot tax protest scheme or argument or process. And before that, there was a tax protest scheme, and before that, there was a tax protest scheme, and it goes on back to about 1963, when the tax protest movement began here in the United States to take on form and shape. And over the years, hundreds of little groups of patriots have been fighting the income tax and driver's licenses and the flag issue, and just, you know, on and on it goes. In an honest desire, I think, on the part of most people, to return America to the Constitution and constitutional due process. A very noble goal. I think a goal that's no longer achievable, but then, you know, everybody has to have something that they dream about or something that they desire. And so that's the part that gets into politics. And so most of these patriot groups are conservative, naturally. And these are people that stand up and wave the flag and they sing the Star Spangled Banner, and they pledge allegiance to the flag. And they want to do away with, or they want to abolish, the Federal Reserve. They want to reduce government, as a general rule. They want to reduce government. They're libertarians in philosophy. And most of these people are just good, hard-working truck drivers and plumbers and electricians and tradespeople, and they're not very well trained in law. And I have never seen a lawyer, a banker, I've seen a few preachers in the groups. No lawyers, no bankers. Professionals aren't really attracted to it so much, as are the fringe professionals, like chiropractors are, but medical doctors aren't. And these people, as a group, as a whole, have little or no legal training. That's the big problem. Have little or no legal training. And then charlatans come in. And then the charlatans come in and they pretend like they've got legal training. And the way they present it is that the income tax is unconstitutional, or some element thereof. And the Congress recognized it and wrote it into the laws, but the IRS and the president and other government agencies are abusing the law, and they're violating the Constitution, and they're taxing the wrong people. And whoever these wrong people are, it's always you are the wrong people, and the right people aren't being taxed. That's the rich people, and the wrong people, that's the carpenters, plumbers, and electricians, are being taxed. I think that just about summarizes the general concept of the Patriot movement and this new wave, this new theory called strawman, which has simply taken the place of the various theories in the past that all failed. And so far, every legal theory that has been advanced since A.J. Porth began the process in 1944 has failed. I don't know of a single process that has succeeded. And I was first introduced to this back in the 1970s, late 1970s. And at that time, it was the income tax is unconstitutional because. And there was about five or six different reasons why the income tax was unconstitutional. In addition to the income tax, various other issues have come into play, like the flag, the fringe on the flag, and birth certificates, and driver's licenses, and various other legal topics have come into the mix. And people will jump on those, and they'll get excited about it, and they try to make some changes. And by and large, without legal training, without a basic understanding of how our Constitution and our judicial system works, these people don't have a prayer. That's the bottom line. They don't have a prayer. Without some kind of training, without some kind of knowledge as to how to take a legal issue, present it to the courts, and then work it through the appellate process to get a decision, a favorable decision, it's just outside the scope of most of these patriots. And so the general policy or rule that they follow is that they stop paying their taxes, then they get into trouble, and then they will grasp at any and every straw available, even straws that aren't available. And this sets a lot of bad case law precedents against us. That's what the bottom line is. And straw man hasn't helped any, and I showed you that right coming right out of the chute, that 8 adverse cases have come down concerning the straw man idea or argument. Now, not everything that these people say is false. They will come along and they'll make a statement. They'll take a real law, like the Uniform Commercial Code, a real body of law, and then they corrupt and pervert it. And then they go out and they sell that, theories and ideas like Jack Smith and Rick Schramm. They go out and they sell this to lay people. And they're con men, is what it really boils down to. So you really have two enemies here. You've got the government, number one, who's taxing and robbing you blind. And then when you try to do something about it, you've got the charlatans that come in and say, well, here's the magic bullet solution. Buy my $75 packet. In some cases, it's many thousands of dollar packet. And this will solve your problem. And then people lose their homes, lose their jobs, lose their careers, are convicted of felonies and put in prison for a period of time, and then after they get this all behind them, they're pretty bitter and pretty disillusioned, which you could readily understand. And there's a lot of bitterness and disillusion coming from the straw man garbage. I'm going to use the word garbage here rather than crazy, because that's just what it is. It's just garbage in, garbage out. Now, I mentioned to you, I received a letter And the letter says, could you do a story on credit card collections and disclosure statements and rules as to third-party debt collection under administrative law and or maritime claims, and then talk about the remedies. That's because there's a lot of straw man talk and or debt elimination due to the lack of backing of U.S. Federal Reserve notes. So could you touch on that subject a bit? All right, that's what we started to do. So today let's take a look here at a couple of three concepts and ideas that lead us to the magic bullet here called straw man. Let's take a look here at a story here that comes off the web called The Secret History of Credit Cards. Watch online PBS, the efforts to get reform. In Secret History of the Credit Card, Frontline. Now, Frontline is a Dateline or a 60 Minutes type program on PBS. And Frontline and the New York Times joined forces to investigate an industry that few Americans fully understand. In this one-hour report, correspondent Lowell Bergman uncovers the techniques used by the industry to earn record profits and get consumers to take on more debt. The almost magical convenience of plastic money is critical to our famously compulsive consumer economy, Bergman says. With more than 641 million credit cards in circulation and accounting for an estimated $1.5 trillion of consumer spending, the U.S. economy has clearly gone plastic. Millions of American families use their personal general-purpose credit cards, such as Visa, MasterCard, American Express, and Discover, to make ends meet. Credit cards have been a discreet lifeline for families in financial straits. But other consumers, like actor and author Ben Stein, use plastic purely for convenience. While it would appear that Stein, who says he charges a small fortune every month on his credit cards, is the ideal customer. In reality, Stein is what some in the industry call a deadbeat. That's because he pays his balance in full every month. The industry's most profitable customers, the ones being sought by creative marketing tactics, are called the revolvers. Those are the estimated 115 million Americans who carry monthly credit card debt or balances. Ed Yingling, incoming president of the American Bankers Association, tells Frontline that revolvers are the sweet spot of the banking industry. And this sweet spot continues to grow as the average credit card debt among American households has more than doubled over the past decade. Today, the average family owes roughly $8,000 on their credit cards. And this debt has helped to generate record profits for the credit card industry. Last year, more than $30 billion before taxes was the profits of the credit card industry. Some experts say the profitability of credit cards really began 25 years ago when the banking industry successfully eliminated a critical restriction: the limit on the interest rate that a lender can charge to a borrower. Deregulation, coupled with a revolution in technology that enables the almost real-time tracking of personal financial information, and the emergence of nationwide banking, has all worked together to facilitate the widening availability of credit cards across the economic spectrum. But for some, the cost of credit is often far greater than it appears. Now, according to Harvard Law professor Elizabeth Warren, the credit card companies are misleading consumers and making up their own rules. These guys have figured out that the best way to compete is to put a smiley face on your commercials, a low introductory rate, and then hire a team of MBAs to lay traps in the fine print. And Warren tells Frontline that the other activities, or the other critics, say that a growing share of the industry's revenue came from what they call deceptive tactics, such as default, terms spelled out in the fine print of the cardholder agreements, the terms and conditions of which can be changed at any time for any reason with 15 days' notice. Penalty fees and rates are sometimes triggered by just a single lapse, a payment that arrives a couple of days or even a couple of hours late, a charge that exceeds the credit line by a few dollars, or a loan from another creditor which renders the cardholder overextended, as defined by the nation's three all-powerful credit bureaus. This flurry of unexpected fees and rate hikes come just when consumers can least afford them. Banks are raising interest rates, adding new fees, making the due date for your payment a holiday or a Sunday, in hopes that maybe you'll trip up and get the payment in late, says Robert McKinley, the founder and chairman of CardWeb.com and RAM Research, a payment card research firm. It's become a very anti-consumer marketplace. Banking Association spokesman Yingling defends industry practices. Because the credit card business is basically unsecured lending, he says the risks associated with the business must be offset by higher rates. But that's of little consolation to consumers who may be in trouble. According to the Better Business Bureau, credit card and banking companies are the subject of a record number of complaints. And it's not an accident that the banking and credit card business generates more complaints nationally across the country than any other industry. Now, one out of 1,000 industries that we track, or out of 1,000 industries that we track, the credit card industry is the number one industry for complaints, says Pat Wallace, who is the head of the San Francisco Bay Area Better Business Bureau. There are irritated, unhappy, dissatisfied customers in this industry. And as Professor Warren sees it, the industry is operating without fear of penalty. There's no regulator, and there's no customer who can bring this industry to heel, Warren says. All right, now there's the story on credit cards. Let's analyze the credit card story. Credit card interest rates vary from 0 to 27%. The average being about 17%. If you were to take $10,000 worth of credit card debt and make the minimum payment, it would take 25 years to pay it off, and it would triple the amount of the debt to $30,000. So what happens over a period of time is what we call the doubling, or the geometric rule. And then it works like this. It goes by 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. There's an interesting story that I was told as a boy. I'll pass it on to you, and I'll show you why it is that once you get into the usury trap, you're dead. Dead on arrival. Now, there's an old adage that goes like this, and it says that gold is the currency of kings. Silver is the currency of gentlemen. Barter is the currency of peasants. And debt is the currency of slaves. When you use a credit card, you're using debt as currency. And there's an old adage that comes from the Bible, and that is that the debtor is servant to the lender. He who has the gold makes the rules. The banks have the gold. The banks make the rules. You use the bank's credit. You are a slave to the bank in a guardian-ward relationship. Now, this is exactly the opposite to what you were told by Moses, or told by God through Moses, in Deuteronomy 28. Let me give you an illustration. In Deuteronomy 28, verse 12, God said, "You shall lend unto many nations, and you shall not borrow. You shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow." Now, that's a benefit. America, until, you know, up in 1950, America was the world's largest or greatest lending nation. We lent to everybody. Everybody owed us, and we didn't owe them. But now it's exactly the opposite. America is now the number one creditor nation, not the number one, we're the world's number one debtor nation, I should say, instead of the world's number one creditor nation. So it's an exact reversal of our history. When we practiced the Ten Commandments, when we practiced the economic laws of God, we were the world's number one economic power. Starting about 1950, we decided that the laws of God, the Ten Commandments in particular, were bad for us and that we wanted a secular nation. And so now we've reversed our position. It's a choice that we made, and it's a choice that you have to live with. Now, you as an individual do not have to have any debt. None. Zero. Zilch. In fact, if you have debt, you're a slave. Ben Stein uses credit cards, remember in the article or the story, for convenience. He's called a deadbeat in the industry because he pays his balance off every month. If you can do that, and 30 million Americans do, 30 million American deadbeats pay their credit card balances off every month. I tried it, and it didn't work for me. I don't have any credit cards. I couldn't manage credit cards. Maybe I could today, but when I was in my 30s, I couldn't handle it. And so I swore off of credit cards like I swore off of tobacco. Now, you know, maybe a guy, there may be some people that can smoke one cigar a week. Or maybe there are some people out there that can drink, you know, just one drink a week or one drink a month, but you know, many people are alcoholic and they take one drink and then they got to have 2, 3, 9, 11, and one guy takes a puff and he's got to have a pack, and one guy's got a credit card and he's got to have 5, and you know, just, you know, people have different weaknesses. And so when I look at these kinds of temptations and weaknesses, and I say to myself, well, I was unable to manage credit cards and credit card debt 40 years ago, what makes me think that I can handle credit cards and credit card debt today? You know, if you don't go down to Flo's Whorehouse, you're not exposed to the temptation, and without the temptation, then you don't have the act. So my common sense says, you know, why don't you just eliminate the temptation? And then you won't have the problem. Now, Ben Stein evidently can handle credit cards and pays them off every month. 30 million Americans can handle credit cards, and they pay them off every month. But 115 million Americans can't. And they have a credit card balance, and this is what they call the sweet spot. Now, if you take a look at geometric progression, the story goes like this. Little boy, he takes a horse down. His daddy sends him down to the farrier to get the horseshoe. And he gets down to the farrier, and the blacksmith says, well, listen, I got a special going today for you, little boy. And what I'll do is this. There's 4 horseshoes, and he hands the boy 4 horseshoes. Says, I'm going to give you these horseshoes free. You can take them home and put the shoes on yourself if you want. Or you can hire me to put the shoes on, and my special is this. I'm just going to charge you a penny to put the first nail in, and I'll charge you 2 pennies for the second nail, and we'll just double it. Each time for 32 nails. 1 penny doubled 32 times. And you can take the change and go down and buy ice cream. Little boy thinks that's a great idea. So he says, go to it. And so he hands the farrier one of his horseshoes, and the farrier picks up 8 nails, and he puts on the first horseshoe. And the first nail is a penny, and the second nail is 2 pennies, and the third nail is 4 pennies, and fourth nail is, 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, and $1.28. Well, it costs $2.56. Just total that up. $2.56 to put on the first shoe. Now watch what happens. It costs $12 to shoe a horse, including the shoes and the nails. You go from $2.56 to $5.12, then $10.24. You're over your $12 by the time we get up here to the 8th nail, or the 11th nail. Just get your famous Sharp EL1197G3 calculator out and plug in 1 times 2, 4, and on up to 32 times, and it will, you double that 32 times, and it'll total $40 million. Got that? $40 million in 32 doublings. A guy back in 1947 put $3 million in trust in Pennsylvania in a bank. And I think at the time the interest rate was 2 or 3%, and his intention, he named the state of Pennsylvania as the beneficiary. And his thinking was that in compounding the interest over a period of time, that there would be enough money in the bank that it could run the entire state government of Pennsylvania. And the guy's right. So just a few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, now this money's been in the bank, $3 million has been in the bank from 1947 to about 1997. And the state legislature in Pennsylvania outlawed it, passed a special law and outlawed it. Now you'd think that the state of Pennsylvania would want that $3 million with compound interest so that the state could run on the interest off of the money rather than operating off of taxes. Now, it was a great idea, but it would bankrupt the state of Pennsylvania, and it ultimately would bankrupt the banking industry, and ultimately would bankrupt the United States of America. If you took one penny and you compounded it at 1% interest, compounded annually from the time of Christ to today, in 2,000 years, it would consume all the money in the world. All the money in the world. Now that's why you have to have a land Sabbath and a Jubilee year to bring economies back into equilibrium, because they go out of equilibrium by geometric progression. So God, in the economic system, said, okay, once every 50 years, we've got to bring everything back into equilibrium, because if it continues on, it goes out until it implodes. And that's where the world's economy is today. It's exacerbated by other problems, like fiat currencies and inflation and other things. But even if you just charged interest, just the interest factor all by itself will destroy every economy on the face of the planet every so many years. I don't know, 200-300 years. And that's where we are today, practicing usury and interest. And that's why usury and interest are banned in the Bible. You can't charge interest, period. It's against the law. You can't charge it, and you can't pay it. If you pay interest on your credit card, then you're an accessory before and after the fact, because you knew that there was an interest charge, and then you went ahead and paid it. And the bank, of course, they're in violation of the usury laws because they're charging the interest to start with, which is strictly prohibited. Now, a lot of people will say to me, well, how are you going to do business without any interest? Or why would anybody want to lend? You know, they get kind of snippy, you know. Ignorance gets snippy. They don't know. They haven't got a clue as to how the system would work without it, so they reject it out of hand. Now, you already know that the interest system won't work indefinitely. You're on the cusp now of a breakdown of the entire monetary system worldwide. And if everybody was working as hard as they could and there wasn't any skullduggery involved in the entire process, it would collapse of its own weight in time anyway, because of geometric progression. Arithmetic progression is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Geometric progression is 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. Arithmetic progression will last forever. Geometric will not. So that's the way that game has to be played. You've got to have a process by which you can level this out, and the process given in the Bible is called the Jubilee year, land Sabbaths and Jubilees. Now, the first plank to the Communist Manifesto calls for the abolition of property and land and the application of all rent of land to public purpose. Now, the commandment that says, thou shalt not steal, is the exact opposite to that. Thou shalt not steal is the anchor or the guarantee of personal, private property. Without the law that says, thou shalt not steal, there can be no private property. So the Ten Commandments and the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto are at exact loggerheads. They're 180 degrees apart from one another. America and Americans have adopted the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto with the abolition of property and land and the application of all rent of land to public purposes and a heavy progressive income tax, that's the second plank, and the centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly, which is the fifth plank, coupled with equal liability of all to labor and the establishment of industrial armies, especially for agriculture. That industrial army is called Social Security. Now, you take those four planks, 1, 2, 5, and 8, and you combine those together, and it destroys private property, and it reduces all of the people that participate in those programs, that is, banking, income tax, Social Security, and the abolition of your right to property. It reduces you to slavery. It's called economic slavery, as opposed to physical bondage, where we hold you on a plantation. We now release you from the plantation, and we simply give you a monetary system that accomplishes all of the same goals. And we take away private ownership of slaves or private ownership of people, and we make the ownership of people public. So all of the people of the United States are owned by an entity called the United States of America, and all of the people called citizens who are owned by that entity, the United States of America, like ants in an ant hive or an ant colony, or bees in a beehive, all work for the queen. They all work for the state. They all work for the government. And, of course, a drone is a government worker, and he gets fed, clothed, and housed. And he gets all of these benefits and pays nothing for them. So being a government worker is a hell of a neat program. It's a wonderful program. And it has been growing here in the United States since its inception back in the 1930s with the New Deal under Franklin Roosevelt. It has grown to such a proportion today that the government is out of control. The government is so big with such a bloated bureaucracy and a bloated economy that it can no longer collect enough taxes to operate, so it has to operate on just credit. And so every year the government taxes you about, close to $11 trillion. The economy is $11 trillion. Out of that $11 trillion economy, the federal government taxes you about $2 trillion, and then they borrow about $250 to $500 billion a year. At least that's what they tell you about. In order to make ends meet, it's unsustainable. And at some point in time, it's going to break down. And then there's a massive readjustment, like we had in the 1930s, a massive readjustment of wealth. And then we print a new currency, and then we start off from there. And those that get readjusted, some gain and some lose. Your objective is to see if you can't be on the gaining side as opposed to the losing side when this transaction transpires. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet 7 days a week. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website, remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about this thing of the UCC argument and straw men. Taking a little different tack today, talking about credit. Where does this credit come from? In analyzing the credit card business, we see that we are taking credit from the banks, which creates a guardian-ward relationship, and we voluntarily pay usury. The usury grows geometrically, and it will ultimately consume all of your wealth. In fact, if you'd stop and think about it for a moment, if you take a student loan, you know, students now, young people, they want to go to college. It's not exactly clear to me why it is they want to go to college, but they are convinced that they need to go to college. And they want to go to college. And the ultimate end of this, if you carry it out to its ultimate end, the government of the United States and the people of the United States would like every person in the United States to be educated in college, college educated. That means that everybody in the country will be a professional. Everybody in the country is going to belong to one of the 15 professions. You're going to be a doctor or a dentist, or you're going to be a lawyer or a preacher, or you're going to be a psychiatrist or an engineer. And when you get to the end of this process, and everybody in the country, every single American is now lettered, and he has a college degree, ask yourself, well, who's going to build the buildings, and who's going to carry the garbage away? Who's going to do the work? The goal of everybody in government is to bring in one friend. It kind of reminds me of the old farmer, you know, he said, well, I'm not a pig. All the land in the world that I want is the land next to mine. Carried to its ultimate conclusion, then he wants all the land in the world, doesn't he? All the land in the world that I want is the land next to mine. If every government employee could bring in one friend into the government, then the ultimate end of that would be that everybody is going to work for the government. Government workers don't work, so nobody's going to work. Well, if nobody works, well, then there isn't going to be any productivity. Somebody has to produce meat, milk, butter, and eggs. Somebody has to do that if you're going to eat. Government employees don't produce any meat, milk, butter, or eggs, but they consume all of the above. So they're consumers, but they're not producers. So in the balance of any economy, there have to be some professionals. No doubt about it. There has to be. And God created a professional class of people to run the government, and they were called Levites. They were the smallest tribe. They represented 1/12. They took 1/10 of the gross domestic product and ran the entire government on 10%. from the delivery of the mail to the operation of the chief executive officer, whose name was Moses. The entire government ran on 10%. Well, today your government doesn't run on 10%. Hell, your taxes over there, there isn't anybody paying 10% tax. Everybody's paying 20, 30, 40%. And with the alternative minimum tax, when the president gave you these famous tax reductions, no, those were tax increases. If the Republicans came to you and said, we're going to increase your taxes, you'd say they're no better than the damn Democrats that keep increasing your taxes. The Democrats, their program is fairly simple. It's raise taxes and then spend those tax dollars to stimulate the economy. The Republicans come along and say, no, when you tax too much, then you take too much out of the economy, and then the economy can't regenerate itself. So let's give tax breaks. But the government has now grown to such a size that we can't give tax breaks. We have to have more taxes. So the Republicans can't come to you and say, we want to raise your taxes. So they say, we're going to give you tax cuts. But at the same time, they gave you the alternative minimum tax. So when they gave you the tax cuts, the alternative minimum tax taxes more than the tax cuts. So in reality, it was a tax increase. It was labeled a tax cut. But the overall net effect of it is you got a tax increase. It's a shifting of the burden of taxation from the rich to the middle class or to the poor. Now, you poor people out there aren't paying any income tax. And I want to share with you this. You know, poor people say, well, I'm not paying any income tax. All of you poor people out there, get this. You're paying all the income tax. All of it. Rich people don't pay any income tax. None. Zero zilch. Corporations don't pay any income tax. So you need to understand how this economy works and how this debt, this credit debt usury system works, so that you can make an intelligent decision as to whether you want to stay in it or get out of it. Now, I looked at it some years back. I said, you know, I don't like this program at all. I think I need to get out. Then, of course, that poses a little problem. How are you going to make a living once you leave the credit debt usury system? Because if you're already in debt with your credit card and you're just barely making ends meet with the use of your credit card by going deeper and deeper in debt, it shouldn't, you know, take a real mental giant to figure out that, you know, let's just take the average Joe six-pack. You got $8,000 worth of credit card debt. Then you got a mortgage on your house. And you're working at a job. And the government takes, between Social Security and your income tax, one-third of everything you create and produce. And let's suppose that you're producing $100,000 a year. The government comes in, takes $33,000 of it away from you, right off the top, which leaves you with $67,000. All right, now you got your mortgage and your interest and all the bills and one thing and another and your credit cards and interest and usury and all the rest, and it consumes the other $66,000. In fact, it not only consumes the $66,000, you can't make ends meet on the $66,000, as evidenced by the fact that, unlike Ben Stein, who pays his credit card debt off every month, you have a credit card balance at the end of every month, and your credit card balance is getting bigger every month. What's that tell you? It's growing 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. You see, it's going to double at some point in the future. And then whatever that number is, it's going to double again at some point in the future. And then double again. And then pretty soon it's going to consume everything that you've got. And that's just the inevitable end of it. Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. And Social Security is good for today. So you people that are drawing it today, you don't have any problem. But in a few years, Social Security is going to be insolvent again. Now, they've already fixed the thing three times. You know, they fixed it once under Jimmy Carter. Then they fixed it once under Ronald Reagan. That was twice. They fixed it twice. And now it's in need of fixing again. And then George Bush came along. He would have been the third one. He said, we got to reform this. And everybody said, no, we don't want any reforming or tampering with Social Security. Well, Bush has got the right idea. He says, hey, you got a Social Security problem. You got a worse problem is Medicare. So the Medicare thing is going to be bankrupt here in a few years. Well, listen, boys and girls, your government can't generate enough money in taxes to pay its bills right now. It has to borrow. And then you got Medicare going broke. I mean, come on, kids. You know, time to wake up and smell the coffee, don't you think? That isn't going to go on forever. It's gone on now for about 70 or 75 years. And maybe it can go on for another 10, 20 years. Hell, maybe it can go on for another 75 years. That'd be 150. That's a doubling, you know, from today. 75 more years, a double. Okay, well, then what are you going to do? All right, it comes to an end at some point in time, and when it does and the shakeout occurs, it's going to be pretty traumatic. Just like the Great Depression was pretty traumatic. So you got to be able to understand how the system works. Let me describe it this way. There's a company out in Idaho. This is the one that I did my original research on, so I'll just tell you the story. It's called Idaho Power. Idaho Power Company was incorporated in 1911. And Idaho Power Company is the biggest industry in the state of Idaho, which isn't saying much because Idaho is a pretty small state. Big piece of real estate with only 1 million people in it. I mean, you know, think of it. You know, you people down in Los Angeles, you know, you got, what is it, 11 million people in this Los Angeles, greater Los Angeles area. The whole state of Idaho, 88,000 square miles, got less than 1 million people in it, or not many more than 1 million. There might be 1 million there now. When I lived there, there wasn't 1 million. And so you got this big piece of real estate, and you got this big company over here, which by, you know, California standards is probably a drop in the bucket, but in Idaho, it's the big, poobah. And so Idaho Power Company pays the greatest amount of tax in the state. It's the, I don't know if they're the biggest employer, but they pay more tax than anybody else. And so about every 10 years, there's this great argument that comes up in the state legislature about raising Idaho Power Company's taxes. Now, remember I said, let's get this straight, Idaho Power Company does not pay any tax. Idaho Power Company has never paid a nickel's worth of tax from 1911 until today, and Idaho Power Company will never pay a nickel's worth of tax as long as they're in existence. Now, why you people are enamored by these corporations and why you want these corporations in corporate capacity in your country, I don't know. I don't know. I guess nobody's ever thought very much about it. But anyway, in the legislature back in about 72, I believe it was, there was this great rhubarb, this brouhaha going on in the state legislature about raising their taxes. So Idaho Power, where they take out a full-page ad in the Idaho Statesman, and they would say, Idaho Power is a good neighbor. And I remember one of their ads said over in, I think it was Gooding County, that they pay 65% of the tax revenue in Gooding County is paid by Idaho Power Company. Gooding County, population 6,000, something like that. You know, about like three blocks in downtown New York. Well, anyway, the legislature, they argued about it, and they jumped up and down. Hell, you know, politicians can be elected or defeated based upon their stand on taxing Idaho Power Company. Well, the thing shook itself out, and they decided to raise Idaho Power Company's tax. And the argument goes like this. Idaho Power Company needs to pay their fair share. You know how that goes. They need to pay their fair share. Let me say it again. Idaho Power Company never paid a nickel's worth of tax in its history. Isn't paying any tax now and never will. And neither does General Motors or Ford. There isn't a corporation in the United States of America that's ever paid a nickel's worth of tax. Never have. Don't now, and never will. And yet somebody's going to say, well, I got the tax statement from General Motors. Why they pay billions of dollars a year in taxes. Why they've got unemployment taxes that they pay, and property taxes that they pay, and all these taxes that they pay. All right, pay attention now, boys and girls. Pay attention. General Motors never paid a nickel's worth of property tax. Nickel's worth of sales tax, a nickel's worth of Social Security tax. They haven't paid for it in the past. They're not paying for it today. And they're never going to pay for it in the future. Corporations don't pay tax. They collect tax and pay it over to the government. So who do they collect it from? Well, who is it that they're collecting it from? Idaho Power Company is spending $8,000 for a page in the Idaho Statesman. This is back in the 70s. $8,000. Where did Idaho Power Company get the $8,000 to buy this ad that says Idaho Power is a good neighbor? Don't raise our taxes. It's bad for business. It's bad for Idaho. It's bad for you. It's bad for everybody. Then on the other side, they're saying Idaho Power needs to pay their fair share. Idaho Power isn't paying their fair share. And the arguments go back and forth, you know, and letters are written to the editors. And I mean, people get excited, you know. Perspiration can come out of the pores of their skin over this issue. All right, so they passed the tax increase, and so, I don't know, it was about a month later or 2 months later, I happened to be perusing the Idaho Statesman, and over in the legal, you know, the legal notices section. You ever read the legal notice section of your newspaper? Most people don't. It's filled with fine print and all kinds of funny words, and nobody wants to read something that's not interesting and exciting, you know, like the Parade or Sunday Supplement or the comic page or something like that. Most Americans, you know, they can read Parade or the comics, but they don't read the legal notices section. So I noticed it was on page 27. In the lower right-hand corner, there was a little blurb about Idaho Power, about a month, maybe 2 months, not too long, but, you know, sometime after this tax increase had been approved by the legislature. A little section down there, maybe it was 2 inches in height, one column wide, in the lower right-hand corner, and it said, Idaho Power Company has applied to the Idaho Public Utility Commission for a rate hike. Rate hike. How do you like that? And so I thought, you know, just 2 months ago we had a tax increase on Idaho Power, and so now we have Idaho Power coming to the PUC saying, hey, we need a rate hike. And the rate hike is what caught my eye. This is what caught my eye. They didn't ask for a rate hike of 3% or 5% or 8% or 2%. They asked for a rate hike of 3.2576% rate increase. And I looked at that odd number. It was 3. It wasn't 3.5. 3.25. 3.75. No. It was 3.2576. Now, I don't know that that last four numbers are correct. I can't remember that, but it was 3% plus this odd amount. And I said, oh, my God, don't tell me. So the next day, I went down to the Secretary of State, and I said, let me have the charter for Idaho Power Company. And I paid the $5, and I got the Idaho Power Company charter. They got chartered back in 1911. I went back and I read the charter. Now, Idaho Power Company is limited to an 8% profit. They're not like General Motors there or like Exxon. They can't make 10, 15, 20. I saw Blue Chip report the other day on Walmart and Microsoft. Microsoft, my God, they make 24% profit on their sales. And Walmart's just right behind them. I mean, I was amazed. I didn't know those big corporations made that kind of profit. But Idaho Power Company, they only make 8%. They don't make 25%. They just make 8%. By law, 8%. That's it. But they're guaranteed that 8%. Period. 8%. And so when you come to Idaho Power Company and you raise their taxes, and it cuts into their 8%, they're entitled to a rate increase. And the rate increase that they needed was this 3% plus this odd amount to bring them back up to their 8%. So Idaho Power Company operates and they deliver your power, and they always make 8% profit on their investment. 8% profit on their investment. So that's why power companies always drive new trucks. You know, us farmers out here, we drive old trucks. Not the power companies. They drive all new trucks. Everything they have is new. And so when Idaho Power Company goes to buy a telephone pole, and they got a telephone pole that they can buy for $30 and a telephone pole that they can buy for $300, which telephone pole do they buy? They buy the $300 telephone pole. Because when they pay $300 for the telephone pole, they pay for that out of cash flow, which then gives them $300 worth of investment, and they get 8% profit off of a $300 power pole, or $24 a year. You follow that? If they buy a $30 power pole, they get 8% of $30, $2.40. So I just thought I'd share that with you. And that's why Idaho Power Company always buys the biggest and the best, and that's why corporations buy the biggest and the best, because they pay for that out of cash flow. They don't have to pay for that out of dividends. And then they live the life of Riley at the tax, not the tax, but the stockholders' expense. And then the guy that paid for the tax increase in Idaho was the poor people. The people whose rate increase, like my power bill was $56 a month and it raised to $59. So I paid my $3, and then tens of thousands of other people paid their $3. You see, the legislature is not stupid. Those politicians aren't dumb. They know that if they raised your taxes $3, you'd be PO'd. So they raise Idaho Power Company's tax $3, and Idaho Power Company raises your power bill by $3 a month, and you're happy as a clam at high tide. And it accomplishes everybody's goal. Idaho Power Company doesn't pay taxes. When they get all through balancing their books at the end of the year, they make 8% profit. They never make a dollar more, and they never make a dollar less. They make 8% a year, and that's what the law requires, and that's what the law permits. That's it. And raising their taxes raises your power bill. The final analysis, Idaho Power doesn't pay taxes, ratepayers do. The rich don't pay taxes, the poor pay taxes. And you simply pay it when you go into McDonald's. McDonald's hamburgers are 5 cents, the same price that they were in 1930. And the reason you're paying $1.39 is because $1.34 of it is tax. They pay 257 taxes on a Big Mac. The 257 taxes amount to $1.34. They sell a hamburger for $1.39. They sell it for the same 5 cents that they did in 1930. And McDonald's doesn't pay tax either. You do. And you pay it every time you buy a Big Mac. So let's hear it. Let's make sure that McDonald's pays their fair share. And let's raise their taxes, so that they will raise their prices, so that you and I can pay more tax. See how that game is played, boys and girls? So the next time you pay your tax, the next time you write your check, the next time you make your credit card payment, you just remember who it is that's paying the tax. And it's not corporate America. Yeah, I'm out of time here, kids. We got to leave it right there. We'll be back tomorrow night talking more about this thing of the UCC and straw men. But keep in mind that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.